This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We like to visit frequently with Jason Turner. He's the Chief Investment Strategist at Wintrust Wealth Management. Jason, what's your overview of the banking industry today? It seems to be every day we get new interpretations or revelations. What are you thinking right now?
Today or this hour, John? I think things have been changing quite a bit in the last week or so. And even this morning, we saw the markets turn around significantly this morning, kind of seesawing between the ECB's rate decision early this morning for us here in the United States, and then some more positive comments as we moved through the morning that has really turned the markets back into the positive.
And about that, what is the positive? What is happening now, and what does it mean for the future?
Well, there was a report out in the Wall Street Journal earlier today that there may be some buyers emerging for First Republic Bank, which has been one of those banks that's been soft-circled, is in trouble or troubled. And just generally for the rest of the banking sector, it looks like there's going to be some additional support from larger banks for smaller banks, some positive comments from the Treasury Secretary in front of Congress just a short time ago have all served to boost markets here and encourage a little bit of a recovery or rally in banking stocks, too.
Would you say there's a number of other banks then that have the same sort of scenario? Maybe not risky loans, but they're heavily invested in T-bills to cover themselves, and the value of those has dropped. If they need equity, now they're a little bit upside down. Are there a lot of banks kind of in that situation?
I don't think this is a systemic problem. Similar to 08 and 09, when we saw a systemic problem with credit, this situation that we're dealing with here with some banks that have not maybe managed their Tier 1 capital the extent they could have, have set themselves up in a difficult situation, but it doesn't appear to be a banking system-wide issue.
So can we heave a sigh of relief?
The unfortunate thing is this is not measured as numbers on paper. I can tell you all you'd ever want to hear about the strength of Tier 1 capital ratios at banks from today compared to 08 and 09. But to steal a term from Jimmy Carter back from the 1970s, what's emerged is a bit of a crisis of confidence in the banks. And when you get these runs on the banks, like Silicon Valley Bank saw late last week, that puts even a well-capitalized bank into a more stressful position.
In fact, that's exactly what happened here, right? It was a bunch of investors in a group chat Saturday morning, and they said, you know, maybe we ought to take our money out. A line from that group said, only upside, no downside. But obviously there was a big downside. But I mean, it would not have happened had those people not gotten spooked, right?
Had people not seen the withdrawals that they had pursued, you're right. They would not have put that much stress on Silicon Valley Bank. Now, they would have already been in a stressful situation,
yes,
given how the bank was managed, and they were selling held-to-maturity securities and having to take large losses to meet those withdrawals, and that's what put them into the trouble that ended in the FDIC situation.
I appreciate you making that distinction. So it might not have happened had they not all gotten spooked, but it doesn't mean that the bank wasn't being mismanaged. Last thing about all of that, is that the right word, mismanaged? Was this a problem with SVB per se?
I would say more aggressively managed. I hate to cast shade on other banks, but The idea that you can maintain a more aggressive stance and a more conservative stance is something the public doesn't necessarily always see with banks, but is certainly there in terms of how banks are managed and how their reserves are managed.
In the continuing theme on the Wintrust Business Lunch of some good news is bad news and some bad news is good news, Jason Turner joins us, Chief Investment Strategist for the Wintrust Wealth Management Group. WintrustWealth.com is the website. We talked a little bit about the banking. You know, everybody doesn't know how to end that sentence or phrase, the banking. I don't know if it's a crisis, because crisis would seem to me more systemic. And you said this is not systemic. Fair enough, Jason?
Fair enough. And I would choose the word turmoil. The markets are certainly roiled by all of this, but this does has a potential to drift into the background as the Fed resumes its fight against inflation over the balance of the rest of this year.
Boy, did that change the game, huh? So now everybody's guessing 25 basis points instead of 50?
Yeah, that's the futures market putting about a 75% probability at the start of the day. Now, after this morning's activity, up to about an 83% probability that we see 25 basis points next week from the Fed. You know, we're only a week removed from Chair Powell's pretty hawkish comments, driving a nearly 80% probability of a 50 basis point.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a week ago.
It's like all of a sudden the 12 seed is back up and the 5 seed is on its heels. What do you think is best for the economy or, say, our retirement assets? I mean, in the world we live in today, is 25 the right call, Jason?
In the world we live in today, where there's so much uncertainty surrounding the situation with the banking sector, and taking into account that the Fed's one of its main purposes is to provide liquidity and stability to the banking sector, and the role they played in pushing this higher with the strong move in rates, 50 basis points would be probably too much at this point. 25 basis points to continue to fight inflation. CPI report this week was pretty strong still. To continue that fight next week with a 25 basis point hike and then take it more of a wait and see approach with an extra month's worth of wait until they get into the May meeting might be the right course of action.
Are you encouraged by the inflation number in February?
The inflation number in February is a little concerning that it remains stubbornly high. Although if we kind of peel back the onion and look, we do see some evidence that inflation will continue to fall going forward. Services inflation is still the strong push. Within that, shelter or rent is a strong push. That likely starts to dissipate because of some trailing impacts as we move through the April report that we won't see until May. As that happens, the Fed will start to see some evidence that their actions have indeed blunted inflation, and we are on a downward path for inflation. We continue to see that in the rest of the report as well.
And is that what we all need to be looking at? I mean, everybody just wants to see inflation go down. So 0.4%, which isn't terrible considering where we were a year ago. So it looks like, you know, we've seen the worst of it, even though you saw an increase of 0.4%. But anyway, what we want is inflation to go down. We need to see that turn, right?
Correct. We need to continue to see inflation follow this downward path that it's followed since late last year. There will be months like this past month where it's marginal. There will be months that it takes a larger step, but as long as it keeps stepping down the stairs, we should feel encouraged by that.
Yeah. The next action by the Fed, what's the date on that again?
The next action by the Fed is next week. So midpoint of next week, we'll see the Fed release its decision. I think we'll hear on Wednesday. And then from that, it'll be the first week of May.
Just about the health of the banking sector in general. Last week, we were talking to various analysts. They said that a good place for money in the market right now would be financials. Is that still the case?
That is a interesting situation to take a look at. If you do believe in the insulated nature of these issues with a couple of banks, everything's been thrown out with the bathwater, and every bank is kind of traded down significantly this week. If you have confidence in the financial sector, confidence in the banking sector, this week likely represented a pretty decent entry point.
It's such a mystery, though. I mean, who among us knows about banking regulations or strategies, let alone Silicon Valley Bank, which a lot of us, at least in the Midwest, hadn't heard about? So I'd like to think that I have, you know, confidence in the banking system in America. If not, we're screwed. But suddenly I'm not sure, because at least now I realize how little I realize. You know, I don't know. It's a conundrum for, I think, people like me.
It certainly is. And that's why I went back to the idea of a crisis of confidence. It's not really about strength on paper, the banking system. On paper, the banking system globally is much better off than it was in 2008, 2009, much stronger.
Yeah.
But it's a crisis of confidence that the average depositor is not sure whether they should take that money out and stuff it under their mattress or leave it in their financial institution.
What do you
and
make?
The numbers would tell you.
Go ahead.
The numbers would tell you to leave it in the financial institution. The amount you're getting paid for your deposits has increased significantly over the last 12 to 18 months. The health of the banking sector still appears on paper to be fairly strong from a Tier 1 capital perspective. The crisis of confidence, if you will, hopefully starts to fade into the background, and we start to talk a lot more about the Fed and fighting inflation than the Fed bailing out the financial system.
What do you think of the long-term consequences of covering deposits above $250,000? Is that going to haunt us, or is this a one-off? What's the analysis of that?
This one right now appears to be a one-off, concentrated on these banks that had issue over the weekend last weekend, and not a blanket insurance by the FDIC of everything above 250. It looks to be just a encouragement for investors and depositors now in the short term. Over the long term, the deposit insurance fund is not nearly large enough to cover those type of losses in a 08-09 type scenario. So I doubt that that is an extension writ large by the Treasury Department across the banking system out into the future.
Yeah, and one would hope not. That's not the way it's supposed to work. Hopefully people realize that, heed that, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Jason Turner, Chief Investment Strategist, Wintrust Wealth Management. Jason, it's always helpful to talk to you. I appreciate your time today.
Good to be with you, John. Thank you.
A lot of us hadn't heard of Silicon Valley Bank, and at first I think we thought, well, that was some sort of West Coast high-tech thing. Our next guest is Dale Buss. He is a veteran financial journalist and founder and executive director of the Flyover Coalition, who has maybe an interesting take on where we fare in the Midwest, or how we fare in the Midwest. Hi, Dale. Welcome back. How have you been?
Thanks, John. Great. Appreciate you taking the time to talk about this from a little bit different perspective. I mean, Silicon Valley Bank is a, you know, West Coast tech-focused thing, and I think that's kind of the part of how I'm viewing this. I mean, obviously, there are lots of implications for the banking system, for global finance, the ripples from the demise of Silicon Valley Bank, you know, reach all the way up to Switzerland, right, at this point, where Credit Suisse has been kind of shaky the last couple of days. But the perspective I have on this is that this, what happened with this bank, represents a little bit of a kind of a folding over on itself of the tech economy. If you combine what happened here and how it's damaged relationships and credibility in that whole area with the continued layoffs of tens of thousands of people by the big tech companies, you know, including Meta and Facebook and many others. And then you combine that with what you've seen happen very recently with a pull-up in Amazon's plans to develop its HQ2, so-called, in Virginia. So all of that adds together to kind of a contraction of the go-go Silicon Valley economy. But what that represents is, I think, an opportunity for flyover country and particularly the upper Midwest. So that, you know, with COVID, you kind of had with remote work, you had a certain dynamic that helped release people to live and work where they wanted to. I think this kind of represents phase two of that, where there is an opportunity for us in these legacy industries in the Midwest and the heartland to, you know, pick up some of the slack and to find an economic opening here where, with tech having slowed down a little bit and facing its obstacles, we have more opportunity. And I guess there's nothing more exemplary of that than this announcement a couple of weeks ago that there's going to be a $250 million investment by, ironically, the founder of Facebook,
yeah,
Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah. I was thinking about that.
I hope this doesn't
jeopardize that. I hope they don't get cold feet.
Well, Facebook's difficulties and the difficulties of these, you know, the big tech giants really started to kick in over a year or two ago before Silicon Valley Bank's problem. So I don't think that in particular is going to be a problem. But it does show how here's an opportunity being presented to Chicago and its universities, a corporate infrastructure around biotech, a legacy industry, if you will, something that's not just writing code for, you know, gamers. You take advantage of the ability to advance by harnessing this investment, attracting more technology workers to the city and to this opportunity. And I think that's an example of more of what we need to do and what we can do to kind of make hay out of this macroeconomic problem.
You know, when you hear the commercials, know your banker and have a relationship with them. My understanding is that Silicon Valley was the kind of bank that sort of understood the tech sector. And so if you came to them with some sort of harebrained idea that might be the next billion-dollar cure for cancer or whatever, you know, they would take that meeting. They might lend you the money. That might not happen in the Midwest because banks just aren't used to dealing with that. Do you agree with that? I mean, that was
the value of a bank like that. That was the value of a bank like that. The problem was twofold. One, they were so intensively invested in Silicon Valley and bigger companies and startups there that when that sector of the economy started to flag, as it has lately, I mean, you can only lay off so many tens of thousands of people and your business slow down before it affects your bank. So that was a problem of heavy investment in that sector. And the second thing was the practices of the Silicon Valley Bank itself, it invested in, you know, T-bills when interest rates were going up, all of that kind of thing. So created kind of a double whammy. The advantage that, you know, so many of the banks have, regional and even community banks in the rest of the country, is that they're diversified. I mean, Chicago banks have relationships with a lot of manufacturers, food processors, service industries. So that is a huge advantage of even regional banks. And again, I think that's where our banks need to kind of stress the relationships that they have on the local and regional level that they can offer that are not available if someone wants to turn to one of the big money center banks, you know, the J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank of America. And that's been part of kind of the flight to safety over the last several days that many businesses are making. But this gives another chance for big regional banks like those in Chicago to say, hey, we've got these advantages. We're stable, we're diversified, and you can have a relationship with us that maybe you can't have with Citibank.
You know, when I heard that, I thought it was Google, but maybe it was Meta overall, but that they had laid off another 10,000 employees. I thought, how many employees do you have? Well, that strikes me as a huge number for something that does not produce physical products. You know, it's a digital corporation.
Isn't it amazing? Well, I think Facebook laid off 10,000 people like last year, or Meta, as they're now called, and that was 13% of their workforce. So now they're talking about maybe another, you know, maybe it's 15 or 17% of the workforce. So they do employ many thousands of people, but, you know, this clearly is a bump in the road for them and a big one. I mean, look at Amazon. Not only are they halting work on their HQ2 headquarters, the most pursued economic development prize in history, really, but they're not building warehouses anymore. So those warehouses you see going up all over the country, these massive, massive buildings, and the reason you can get something today that you ordered 2 hours ago, they've stopped building them.
Oh,
so
really?
This is a real reset in the economic engine that we've been used to for the last 10, 15, 20 years. And that's why I'm saying it's a real opportunity for companies that aren't in that ecosystem to, you know, to do better and to take advantage of it and harness technology in ways that we can use some of the workers that have been loosed up, some of the capital that's been loosed up.
Dale Buss is the executive director of an organization called the Flyover Coalition. You see why. Incidentally, one of our listeners just texted in to say maybe we should stop calling our region the Midwest. We do not aspire to be the West. How about Heartland or Great Lakes states, Great Plains states?
Heartland's great, and the reason I call it Flyover Country is people identify with it. It's like you know who you are if you live here.
And, amen to that.
Yeah. We want to make it ironic rather than descriptive.
It's a 12:45. Okay, Dale, keep doing what you're doing. I appreciate your interesting observation today. Thanks for joining us.
You likewise. Thank you.
That's Dale Buss from the Flyover Coalition, flyovercoalition.org. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. There's been some volatile trading following the collapse of two big banks, including Silicon Valley Bank, and trading volume at CME in Chicago hit a record high earlier this week as a result. The futures and options exchange hit the record on Monday, March 13th. Trading volumes were highest among short-term interest rate futures and futures contracts on certain equity indices. Investors have been jittery about the health of the banking sector. CME is no stranger to volatile trading. It's where investors go to protect themselves or profit from market uncertainty. Kellogg has picked a name for its new snack business that'll be headquartered in Chicago. It'll be called Kellanova. mixing the first part of Kellogg and the Latin word for new. Kellanova will be the brand for Kellogg's $14 billion snack business that includes products like Pop-Tarts, Pringles, Eggo, Rice Krispies, Treats, Cheez-It, RX Bar, and Morningstar Farms. Kellogg will spin off the snack business officially later this year. Kellogg had been calling the companies North American Cereal and Global Snacking. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We've got the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Thank you. I'm going to talk about cleathrophobia for a moment after I tell you we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, cleathrophobia, a cousin of claustrophobia, is the fear of being trapped, maybe in a small enclosed space, or, as it relates to the business of food, and I hope this is not nightmare fodder for you, but imagine that you are in grain up to your waist.
Yeah, you're stuck. You can't move.
And it doesn't take much to get stuck.
Most people will become entrapped when the grain gets just above their knees.
It happens dozens of times every year, and more often than not, about 60% of the time, the person trapped does not survive, either because they are working alone and aren't found until it's too late, or rescuers don't have the proper tools to get them out. That's where Dan Neenan comes in. He is director of the National Education Center for Agriculture Safety.
So we just in the month of February had our 33rd and 34th fire department that we've trained have a successful rescue.
Or put another way,
you know, that's 34 people that are at the dinner table tonight that wouldn't have been.
About 15 years ago, something called a grain tube was invented for grain bin rescues. It isn't really a tube. It's made up of panels that are sunk into the grain around the person who's trapped.
So we're going to build those six panels in a circle around them, starting as close to their back as we can. Then we're going to sink that tube down around them. And then we're going to start evacuating the grain.
They do work. It takes a while, though.
An average grain bin rescue time from the time the fire department gets on scene is 3.5 hours.
So every year for the past 9, the Center for Agriculture Safety has been giving away tubes and training to fire departments, many of them small volunteer departments.
And they run off of shoestring budgets, so that's why they can't afford to buy that equipment on their own.
If you want to nominate a department to get tubes and training, go to greenbinsafetyweek.com. April 30th is the deadline. Or if you'd like to buy a grain tube and training for your department, $5,000 bucks, but seems worth it. GrainBinSafetyWeek.com, and a thumbs up to Nationwide Insurance for helping pay for the program. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
You want to have some fun? Here's the person to talk to, Adam Elias, the CEO of Whirly Ball. Okay, now it's your turn, Adam. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me back.
You guys have been in business for 30 years, did I see?
3 decades. We just hit that milestone, and it feels fantastic to be at this point.
I know what it is, but for those who don't, what is Whirly Ball?
Well, for those that have not gotten out on the court, Whirly Ball is the combination of basketball, lacrosse, and hockey all rolled into one. Think of you and 9 of your friends are out on a basketball court, but you're all driving around in bumper cars. Yeah, the ones that you may have seen at the carnival or at another place, but these whirly bugs, we call them that because they can go forwards, backwards, they're super agile, and you play with what looks like the top of a lacrosse scoop. We pass around a wiffle ball. You play a 12-inch size softball size. And the goal is to shoot that wiffle ball into a basketball backboard. Yep, the backboard has a circle in the middle, and the goal is to shoot the ball in the middle hole, and you get 2 points for scoring. Just like in basketball, if you hit it past the half-court point, which is our three-point line, you can get 3 points. And just like in basketball, if your team scores, the other team's ball. Games are usually played at 10 minutes, and then we rent the court by the hour, so you and your group can play at least 5, if not 6 games in the hour time, and we will customize your event experience for each group. And then we have so much more in each of our locations that I can get into in a little bit.
Is it nice that you don't have to be a great athlete to enjoy what is a kind of athletic adventure, right? Like, we're scoring points. I'm on a team. But I'm not a great athlete. I didn't play basketball. Maybe it doesn't matter so much. Or if somebody's a stud, they don't have a huge advantage. Wouldn't you say that's all true?
That's extremely true. We look at Whirly Ball as a perfect leveling of the playing field, as it is literally the most fun you can have, going 4 miles an hour, and everybody's going the same speed, whether you're an athlete or not, competitive or not. Your true colors come out on the court, which is why Whirly Ball is perfect for corporate team building and bringing people together from all different parts of the organization, as well as grabbing a group of friends and having a night out where it's not something that people are going to be afraid to try because everyone's going to try it together and do something new. And it's frankly a lot of fun. If you ever see anyone playing whirlyball or anyone listening has played, I'm sure you looked around the court and everybody around you is smiling. And that just tells you that they're having a really good time.
The locations are in Chicago, Naperville, Vernon Hills, Brookfield, Wisconsin, Colorado Springs, Colorado. You go and open up some new courts?
Yeah, we are in the process of looking at new markets to take whirlyball throughout the United States so more people can enjoy the experience and have some fun with us. You know, as I briefly mentioned, not only do we have the game of whirlyball, but it's a full entertainment mecca that we've built where we have 12 lanes of bowling with laneside service. So you get, you know, food and drink brought to your lane. With a more elevated experience, we have a multi-level laser tag arena that can have up to 30 players at once. And then we also have private meeting spaces, so which can be used for events, whether that's a mitzvah or a bar mitzvah. We also have corporate meeting space where you can have full AV projection that we have in-house and have all those elements included. So you can have a full corporate meeting and then break out and have some fun afterwards and do everything in one place.
Adam Elias is the CEO at Whirlyball. You want to play? You want to know more? Whirlyball.com. Okay, Adam, well done. I like the sound of your voice, and we need more stuff like this in the world. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to seeing you on the court soon.
They've been doing it for 30 years.